freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And our focus for this month especially is on those missions that are here at home primarily. Though we'll be hearing from our global missionaries, we want to remember those who are serving right here at home. And we are so thankful to have a young man here with us today. And it's not often I get to say this, that I've known the guest speaker for practically his entire whole life. Christian and our oldest son, Phil, have been best friends since, I don't know, creation, something like that. I think it was both of them, they wrote on their Bible college applications, we'd like to be in each other's room because we're basically one and the same person. But I am so thankful to God for this young man and his wife, Elise. And I have been following their ministry throughout their time and their service. And it's so exciting to be able to have both Christian and Elise with us this morning. I'm going to allow Christian to share the ministry of M2W2. And at the end of his message, we're going to share how we as a church today can participate financially in this ministry. So let's give a great Sydney Highway Christian Fellowship welcome to Christian Brower as he comes to share.
Thanks, Ralph. All right. Yeah, so as Pastor Ralph has said, I have known them since I was born, I think. My parents and then Ralph and Sue were pastors at the same church in Ontario. And then me and Phil were great friends, and I have lots of memories from when we were young, maybe 7 or 8 years old, and we'd be wrestling Pastor Ralph in Lake Ontario, and we'd be, you know, wrestling with him. He was younger and stronger then, but I think I could take him now. I'm pretty sure I could take him now. But yeah, my name is Christian, and it's great to be here this morning. I attended Summit Pacific Bible College in Abbotsford and graduated in 2012, same year as Phil. And then since then, up until this year, I was a youth pastor in Surrey at a church called West Winds Community Church, and I was a youth pastor there for 10 years. And then I finished this summer, and I've been working with M2W2 since April, and then been full-time since July. And so it's been awesome for me to be a part of. And before I get into my message this morning, I'll give you a bit of a background of M2W2. We are a Christian organization that's been around for over 50 years. It's been around a long, long time. And our mission is to empower and equip volunteers to build practical mentoring relationships with people affected by incarceration. That's why we exist, that's what we do. And we have three main programs. Program number one that we have is our prison mentorship program. That program is mainly all volunteers who go inside prison institutions and match with a male or a female. So if you're a male volunteer, you'd match with a male. If you're a female volunteer, you'd match with a female. And you mentor them. You have conversations with them. You do life with them. You're trying to build a relationship that's going to help them succeed once they get outside in the community. And you'd be shocked at how appreciative they are to those relationships and how meaningful they are, because a lot of them, through situations and circumstances, don't have really anyone else coming to speak with them. So that's really important. Our second program is our NOLA program, which stands for No One Leaves Alone. And that's the program that I mainly work with. And that program has been around for just a few years. And that program exists for when folks come out of prison, we try to help them get back on their feet, try to help them get their life back on track in five main areas. We help in health, housing, relationships, education, and employment. So a lot of times what happens is people come out of prison and they really don't have anything to go to. They don't have maybe a lot of relationships on the outside that can help them. They have to find a job. Maybe they don't have a lot of skills that can transfer to that because of how they've grown up in their life. Sometimes they literally are left to just find their own place to live. And there's been times where if someone's been in prison for a number of years, the world's online now, and so it's hard for them to adjust. And so we try to really help them get their lives together and back on track and offer support for them. That's our NOLA program. And then our last program, we have two thrift stores that we operate, one in Abbotsford and one in Chilliwack, and those also work as work experience programs for people who are coming out of prison. So they can get experience working in a place and get some experience on their resume and that sort of thing. So those are our three main programs. It's awesome also today to have Phil, who's right there with us this morning, who's the volunteer coordinator at William Head Institution that we'll talk a little bit about later on. But it's great to have him here. He's been with MTW2, he was saying, volunteer coordinator for 6, 7, 8 years, something like that. He's lost track. It's been so good. And so that's our three main programs. But today my sermon is going to explain why I believe this ministry is very important. And the title that I have this morning is The Forgotten Words of Jesus. The Forgotten Words of Jesus. Have you ever made a promise to someone or you told someone something that you forgot about but they reminded you about? If you're married, you've done it. I promise you, you've done it. You've done it. You're like, you're sitting there, maybe you're on the couch, and your wife or your husband comes home, and they say, hey, did you do that? You're like, oh, was I supposed to do that? Like, yeah, you said you would. I don't remember that. It's like, no, it happened. It definitely happened. Oh, are you sure? No, I'm sure. It definitely happened, right? We say things that we forget. If you have kids, I'm sure you've experienced that as well. You ask your kid to do something, maybe put their dishes away, maybe put away their toys, put away their laundry, and it just like never happens. And they say, oh, I forgot. I totally forgot. But then if you make them a promise about ice cream, they remember it like 6 months later. And so it's amazing how that works out. But we make promises. We say things that we forget, right? I do that a lot. We say things and we forget, or we make a promise that we forget. But if there's one person whose words we should try not to forget, it would be Jesus's words. We should try not to forget those words. But if you're like me, sometimes, although I may look like I'm like this, you know, perfect, I never make any mistakes, I still do. I still make mistakes, and I forget his words sometimes. So this morning, I want to speak from a verse that is a well-known verse, but I've always, up until recently, glossed over a part of it. And it's in Matthew 25, verses 31 to 40. And it says this, when the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on the left. And the king will say to those on the right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me a drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you a drink? And when did we see a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer to him, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of my brothers, you did it to me. Now, I have heard this verse before. I'm sure most of you probably have as well. But the one part that I never really paid as close attention to was that last part where it says, when you were in prison, you came to see me. Because this passage sums up how we as believers should act, right? It says, hey, when you see someone who needs food, we should be as believers, as followers of Jesus, people who try to meet that need. If people need food, we feed them. If people need clothing, we clothe them. If they need shelter or medical care, we help. But it also says, if they're in prison, we visit them. And we can gloss over that part, and it's probably the hardest one to do. And the question I want to look at this morning is, why is that so hard? Like, why would that one be the hardest one? And I think the answer to that question is this. It is much easier for us to help those who we think deserve it. It's much easier for us to help those who we think deserve it or have earned it. But much harder to help people when we feel like they haven't done those things. If it's kids who are hungry, we think, of course, we want to help them. If it's a single parent, we want to help them. If it's families in poverty, we want to help them. But it's much harder to help those when we feel like they may not deserve it. Maybe it's someone who has a history with drug issues, or maybe it's someone who we gave advice to and they didn't listen to us. You ever have that, where you give advice, they don't listen, then it goes bad, and you're like, I told you, right? Should have listened to me. Or maybe it's people who have been convicted of a crime, right? We feel like maybe they don't deserve our help. They made their bad choice, and they have to live with it. And we like to play judge and jury to help those who we think deserve it. So when I was a youth pastor, we had different fundraising events that we would do to put on for different ministry programs that we would offer. And sometimes I'd go into the community to different businesses and shops and say, hey, I'm a youth pastor. We're putting on this event trying to help support teens and kids. And would you be willing to donate something for our, you know, event or our auction to be, you know, sold to proceed our youth program? And not always, but we'd get pretty good interest. And they'd say, oh, for a youth program? That's awesome. That's great. You know what? Yeah, we'll do this. We'll give that. We'll give this. If I'm to go in now and I say, hey, I work with people who have come out of prison, would you be interested in giving? Most times they're going to be like, that's not as an easy sell to people. It's just not. They're not really interested in that, because you can feel good about like, oh, I'm helping kids. I'm helping teens. That's great. I feel good about that. But it's harder to feel good about helping people who have maybe made a bad choice. It's in our nature to want to decide, okay, who deserves this help, or to think that we know who really would appreciate it. But that's dangerous, because that's not what Jesus calls us to do. Nowhere does it say in Matthew 25 that I just read, help in those areas if they earned it. Nowhere does it say in Matthew 25, help in these areas if they deserve it. Doesn't say feed the hungry if they work hard. Doesn't say clothe people if they deserve it. Or give shelter to ones who haven't made bad choices. But we like to help people who we think deserve it. It's interesting too, when we give presents, if it's someone's birthday or if it's, you know, Christmas, and we give a present or a gift to someone, it's always nice to kind of get some sort of positive reaction back, right? If you give someone a gift and they say, oh, thank you so much, you're like, oh, they really appreciate it, that's great. It's always good to get some sort of reaction back. If I was to, my dad and Pastor Ralph are really into old cars and that kind of stuff, probably more so my dad, but if I said, hey, Ralph, I somehow got this really nice old car and I gave it to him, I would think he'd be like, wow, thank you so much, that's amazing, right? You kind of want this. I don't have a car, but by the way, if I had one, don't get too excited, if I had one. Yeah. But we get excited, right? And we'd want some sort of reaction. If you do something nice, you kind of want a reaction. But if I did that for Ralph, hypothetically, of course, and he was like, cool, thanks, I'd be like, what? Do you know, this is a car, like, or this is whatever, right? But when we give something, we like to get some type of reaction. Now, for this, my wife, Elise, she gives the best reaction. If you give her something, it's like the best reaction. I could give her something so small, and I feel like I just gave her the best thing in the world. She's the best person to get gifts to. I am not so good. I don't give really good reactions. So there was a time when we were first married where my wife would do something really nice. I'm like, I really thought through this present or this gift or this thing for you. Here you go. I'd say, wow, like, thank you. She's like, that's it? Like, you don't like it? I'm like, no, I really like it. She's like, it doesn't seem like you like it. I'm like, no, I actually like it. But we give different reactions, right? But it's easier to help people, or it's a better response when you give something to someone if it's a good response back, right? But we have to be careful that that's not the reason why we do those things. If we give, it's because we want to give. It's not because we want to get, right? If we're giving someone to something, it shouldn't be about how they respond back to us. It's because we want to give. But we make those ideas in our mind, and we make those judgments in our mind about who deserves what or how we should help or who, we make those things. But here's how we can avoid that. Here's how we can help avoid that attitude of helping people or deciding who deserves what and how we serve others, okay? We need to ask ourselves one question. If we want to stop ourselves from thinking about who deserves what and making those ideas, we need to ask ourselves one question, and that question is this: what if God gave me what I deserve? Right? What if God gave me what I deserve? I don't want that. I don't want that, right? I don't think any of us want that, right? Like, the Bible's clear that we're born into sin, and we sin, and we make wrong mistakes. Even after how long we've been in the faith, we still make mistakes. And if we got what we deserved, that wouldn't be a good thing. But because of Jesus, we can get grace, we can get hope, and we can get life. So what stops us from having that attitude with others is asking ourselves that question: what if God gave me what I deserve? Because we are called to model Jesus. And if he doesn't give us what we deserve, then how can we try to give others what we think they deserve? In Matthew 18, it gives us another example of this. Matthew 18, verses 21 to 35. It says, "Then Peter came up and said to him, 'Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him? As many as seven times?' Jesus said to him, 'I do not say to you seven times, but 70 times seven. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his servants. And when he began to settle, one was brought before him who owed 10,000 talents, a lot of money. And since he could not pay, his master ordered him to be sold, and his wife and children, all that he had, and payment to be made. So the servant fell on his knees, imploring him, 'Have patience with me, I will pay you everything.' And out of pity for him, the master of the servant released him, forgave him the debt. But when that same servant went out, and he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii, and seizing him, he began to choke him, saying, 'Pay me what you owe me.' So his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with him, 'Have patience with me, and I will pay you.' And he refused, and he went and put him in prison until he should have the debt paid. When his fellow servants saw what had taken place, they were greatly dismayed, and they went and reported to their master all that had taken place. And then his master summoned him and said to him, 'You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. And should not you have had mercy on your fellow servant as I have had mercy on you?' And in his anger, his master delivered him to the jailers until he pay all his debt. So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from your heart." This is a great example of that idea of we don't get what we deserve. God gives us grace. God gives us forgiveness. God gives us mercy. The songs that we were singing this morning were beautiful examples of that, that there's grace, that there's mercy, that he's faithful. How then can we in turn not respond in the same to others? If we've received that, how can we not respond in that same way to others? Now, before I go on how you can help and how you can be involved, I want to leave you with a thought and then ask you a question. And the thought is this: imagine for a minute what it would be like to be known by the, or defined by, the worst thing you ever did. I wouldn't want that either, right? If you were known and defined by the worst thing that you've ever done, and not only that, but like almost everyone knows it. That starts to become who you think you are. That starts to become, you know what, maybe that's who I am. That's the worst thing I've done. That's just who I am now. So part of what we do is when I'm meeting with folks who are just released out of prison and who are wanting mentorship and who are wanting relationship, we do that. And they don't have to be a believer. They don't have to be a Christian, but they know that we are. And so there's times where that conversation can come up, and we don't push it on people, but it can come up. And so there was one guy I was working with, and he had started going to church here and there. And then I said, "Oh, well, is there like a Bible study, or is there like a home group that you can get involved in?" He said, "Yeah, there is, and yeah, I might do that." And I said, "Okay, that'd be a great thing." And then over the next few weeks, I'd keep asking him. I'd say, "Hey, like, why aren't you get involved in these home groups? That'd be a great thing." He's like, "Yeah, they invited me." I'm like, "Well, that'd be so good. Well, you should do that." And he kept kind of like not really doing it. And finally I said, "Hey man," like, you know, I knew him a bit. There's some accountability there. I said, "You keep talking about it, but like, you should actually do it. Like, enough talk, you should do it." And here's what he said to me. He said, "Here's the thing, Christian. with the conditions that I have right now of my release, if I go to someone's home, my parole officer has to actually call every person who's going to be at that meeting and go over all the stuff that, like, I've done. So, like, all, like, drug history or whatever it was. And he said, I don't really want all that to be, like, how everyone sees me there. Like, before I show up, everything that is on my, like, index of what I've done is now shared with every person who has to be there. And I remember thinking, like, that's fair. You know what? I'm sorry. I shouldn't have been pushing you. But that would be hard, right? Because then immediately he walks into this study or this home group or whatever it was, and it's everyone already knows the worst thing that he's done. That would be hard. That would be challenging to recover from. So now the question. That was the thought. Now the question is, when we look at Scripture, who was the first person that Jesus took the place for on the cross? It was Barabbas, right? The first person he actually died for, the first person he took his place for was Barabbas, a criminal. That was the first person he took the place for. And Barabbas had done some terrible things. And of course, we know the story, we know how it all went down. But Jesus never fought that. He went and said, that's fine. And we never hear about Barabbas again. We never hear about, like, man, like, that was, would he take that and, like, learn from that and change his life? Like, would Barabbas leave that situation and say, man, like, this man who's innocent, like, died and took my spot? Like, maybe I should, you know, change my life. We don't hear about that ever again. We don't hear about Barabbas ever again. And I think that's on purpose. Because it doesn't actually matter what Barabbas did next. Because that's not why Jesus took his place. Jesus didn't take his place because, hey, I'll do this, but you better do this. It was, I'll do this because I love you. It was never okay, I'll do this, but you have to do this for me, right? We make that, we kind of have those conversations sometimes with people that we love or our family, like, fine, I'll do this, but, like, you owe me one. Like, we do that, right? I'll do this, but can you do this for me later? That's not what it was, because it doesn't matter what Barabbas did next. Barabbas didn't earn or deserve it, but Jesus took his place anyway. Jesus was loving Barabbas. The first person he died for was a criminal, and the last person he witnessed to before he died was the person next to him on the cross, also a convicted criminal. It's pretty clear that Jesus is okay interacting with these people. It's pretty clear that Jesus is okay with these people changing their lives, that there's room for them. Because it's not about who has deserved it or who has earned it. It's about who Jesus tells us to help. And it's for him to decide. He's the one that is the judge, not me. I don't want to be the judge. I want to finish with a story. One of the clients that I work with, and I won't say his name for confidentiality purpose, one of the clients that I worked with, he had been in prison for 45 out of his about 65 years of life. And he had first went inside at about age 15. So if you do the quick math there, about 45 out of 50 years, he'd been in prison. So his whole life, basically. And so that's where he's at. And now when he's in prison, he actually became a Christian through M2W2 mentorship. And through people who are meeting with him, he becomes a Christian, and he starts to, you know, change how he thinks about things, and his life and his personality starts to change. And eventually he gets out of prison, and he becomes one of the people that I work with. And I would meet with him and a couple other volunteers at, like, a Tim Hortons or a park, and we just have a good time and just check in, how you doing? And he didn't have any family or friends around, right? So we were just, you know, giving relationship, and he knew that we were Christian and all that sort of stuff. And so he would start asking us questions about God and say, hey, I read this in Scripture, I didn't know what it meant, which even that in general is an amazing thing. Like, he became a Christian after this whole life of one way. Like, he had been abused, neglected. He'd been stabbed multiple times. He'd been shot. Like, all these things, becomes a Christian. And he's asking me, hey, Christian, I read this in the Bible. What does it mean by that? Like, isn't that amazing? And so we'd have these conversations, and he'd ask this question, and he'd say things like, hey, like, Christian, like I'm trying to quit smoking. I'm really trying, but it's been really hard, and so I still struggle sometimes. Like, does that mean I'm out? Like, am I not a Christian anymore? I'm like, no, you're okay. It's, you know. But we had those conversations, and he always asked me these questions, which was amazing. And eventually we built a relationship, and he was a funny guy. We'd be sarcastic, and we built a relationship, and eventually he said, hey, like, can part of our meetings be a Bible study? I said, absolutely. And so part of our meetings each week, we'd have a little bit of Bible study, and we'd pray together and have this amazing time. I was even, I play on a baseball team in Abbotsford, actually with Phil, Pastor Ralph and Pastor Sue's son, and I was able to bring him to one of my games because he used to love baseball. And I said, like, well, can I come to a game? Absolutely. And so I brought him to one of my games. We watched the game and then went to McDonald's afterwards, which would be like a pretty average night for most people, and he told me that was the best night he could remember. Best night he could remember. The next day was a Friday, and I was driving him to a doctor's appointment, and he asked me a question I'll never forget. He said, hey, Christian, I know that you say that God forgives us, and I'm so thankful for that. Like, it blows my mind that after all the things that I've done, God could forgive me. Blows my mind. That's amazing. And he was so appreciative. He said, I don't want to take advantage, but I still make mistakes. Like, I still mess up. I still have, you know, I still talk the way I shouldn't talk sometimes. I still make mistakes, but I'm really trying, but I don't want God to feel like I'm not being serious about this. But I am really trying. And he said to me, is there still room for me? Is there still room for me? It was so genuine. It was so sincere. I could tell it was really bothering him. What's interesting is just that day when I picked him up, because he was always late, I had to ask someone, hey, can you send this guy down? I said, so I saw another person who lived in that house, another person who was, it's a halfway house, another person who'd been inside. And I say, hey, can you send him down? And they say, who's that? I say, I'm trying to describe him. And he says, oh, the Christian guy. And I said, yeah, the Christian guy. Yeah, I'll send him down. So clearly his life had changed, if that's how he's known inside this halfway house. So he comes down, he says, is there, and we go out for, that was the night of the baseball game. So he says, is there room for me? And in that moment, scripture came to me, and I said to him, I said, the Bible tells us that his grace is sufficient for us, that his power is made perfect in weakness. So even when we make mistakes, even when we struggle, of course, his grace is enough for us. So of course, there is room for you. In fact, because you're going to have a lot of company because we all make mistakes. You're going to be just fine. And he said to me, oh, that's amazing. That's so amazing. Like, oh, man, isn't God good? I said, absolutely he is. Absolutely he is. And this man, this time of his life he's in a wheelchair. And so we're at his appointment. And I drop him off and he struggles to stand up and he gives me a hug and says, I love you, brother. I said, I love you too. Like, well, I'll see you next week. That was Friday, just a few weeks back. 4 days later, I get a call from his parole officer, and I'm thinking, oh no, like, did something happen? And they informed me that early this morning, that morning, he had passed away. His lungs had failed. And the first thought that comes to my mind is, the last conversation I have with him is he's talking with me saying, after all I've done, is there room for me? Is there room for me? And I was able to tell him, absolutely there is room for you. There is absolutely room for you. God's grace is amazing, and I'm sure all of us here have experienced it in some type of way. And our mission at M2W2 is to try to extend that to others that almost no one else will. He is a person that never would have had that trajectory of his life if M2W2 didn't exist. I can confidently say that. After all that had gone on in his life, his last conversation with me is, hey, is there room for me? And he is known in his halfway house as the Christian guy. These people that we work with are not lost causes. And a lot of times they get treated like that, but they are not lost causes. They are people who have maybe been in the gutter their whole lives, and they just need someone to extend a hand of Christian love and grace and show them who Jesus is to pull them out. When I was in Sunday school as a kid, there was this song that I loved. And it was this, you know, fun song where it's talking about the house of God. It says, it's a big, big house with lots of rooms. It's a big, big table with lots of chairs, lots of space. It's my Father's house. And the amazing thing about the house of God is that there is always room for one more. There is always room for one more. So now, I'm going to quickly go over how you can help with the ministry of MTW2. Number one is prayer. I was actually talking with Phil this morning, and he was saying, and he said a great thing I loved. He said, not everyone can maybe go inside, or not everyone can maybe give financially, but everyone can pray. Everyone can pray. So you can pray for us. There's actually a way that you can join our mailing list. If you are on email, you can go to our website, mtw2.com, and if you stay there for like a minute or two, this like little pop-up will happen. I know pop-ups normally you don't like, but a pop-up will happen, and it'll say, hey, what's your name? Do you want to stay in touch? And you'll get like our monthly prayer newsletter, prayer calendar of things that you can pray for. And it's confidential, so we don't give like specific names. We might give initials or things like that, but God knows who they are. We all know that. And you can pray for us. You can pray for the people that we work with. So number one is prayer. Number two is you can actually volunteer with us. Now, our NOLA program right now is on the mainland, on the lower mainland. But as I was saying, William Head Institution is here. And our volunteer coordinator, Phil, is here this morning. And we were talking this morning, he says, I always need volunteers. Someone who can come in and just say, hey, let me just listen to you. Let me hear about who you are, you know, let me hear about your story. Let me just model, to use Phil's word, model God's love and grace to someone. You can always use volunteers. And so if you were interested in what that would look like, myself and Phil are going to be in the foyer after the service. But Phil's the person you want to talk to because he's the one that's going to be actually connecting you and he's going to have all the information that you're going to need. And so Phil would be a great person to ask, hey, what would it actually look like? Because sometimes we have this idea about like what going into like a prison would be like, and it's because we've watched TV or the movies. I promise you it's not like that. But that's what we think, right? We're like, oh man, like, you're walking in, like you're kind of scared. And maybe it's still not for you and that's okay, but talking with Phil, I think, will put your mind at ease for a lot of those concerns. And the last thing is, as Pastor Ruff had said earlier, is finances. So the money that we raise goes to supporting people like the person I just mentioned. It goes to practical things like food or clothing or work stuff or a bus pass so they can actually get to work. Because what happens is people come out of prison and they have nothing and they're so worse off that they were actually in prison that sometimes they actually go back on purpose because they know nothing different. The world has passed them by and we're just trying to help them catch up. One time I heard a story that broke my heart. And it was my boss telling me that he was on the phone with someone and they were trying to find him a place to live. He's coming out of prison. He doesn't have anywhere to go. And this is what he said, word for word. He said, could you just get me one of those good plastic-coated cardboard boxes? One of the ones that can withstand the rain? Like, that'll be awesome. Could you do that for me? And he's serious. That's what he's asking for. So our finances go to helping them find places where they can stay and live and work and to have food, practical things. Because what happens is if they can't do those things, they're going to reoffend and they're going to go back to prison. And so we want to help them avoid that. And so that is the kind of support that we give. So I'm going to invite Pastor Ralph to come up and he can give some more information about how that would work for Highway Christian Fellowship. Thank you, everyone.
Wow. I have to be honest, Christian, you woke me up this morning because it's so easy to fall asleep, to know the Lord, to say, yeah, we know these things in our head, but to hear this, and we've heard your heart, and we've heard what God is saying to us this morning. It's been like a wake-up call to us all. Two things. Christian has mentioned one, and we will partner in prayer definitely. This morning, we would also like to bless